1822. That's also the year a young Irish convict named Garrett Cotter arrived in Old Sydney Town. His story has been told by writer and farmer Richard Begbie in a book simply called Cotter. It's set in the country between present-day Yass and Cooma, and Michael Cathcart asked Richard Begbie about his own connection to that place.
I have a number of connections, but the primary one is that this Cotter's great-grandson was my farming neighbour during the 1970s, and that was where I first began to hear the story.
Oh, so you got talking to the bloke next door about one of his ancestors.
Exactly. And I knew, I mean, the Cotter name to anyone in Canberra or who's visited Canberra almost is a well-known name because of the river and the dam and all the rest of it named after him.
Yeah, there's a Cotter Dam and a Cotter River. And what do you farm yourself, Richard?
I've been growing superfine wool for many years.
Right. So you've been on the land for how long?
Oh, about 40-odd years, yes.
Well, let's talk about Mr. Cotter. The Mr. Cotter of your book. So he's caught up in the terrible sufferings of Ireland in the early 19th century, and he stands up to the landlord. This is really why he gets into trouble, because he engages in this rather ill-judged protest against the landlord. So he's mixed up with a movement called the White Boys. Who were they?
Well, the White Boys, and they had various names actually, but the White Boys they're most commonly called were just a loose association of rebels from the bottom up, so to speak, and they'd form themselves into loose groups and go and try and terrorise the landlords into improving their absolutely shocking, of course, conditions.
Mm. Well, it doesn't work out very well, this plan to upset the landlord. He gets transported, Mr. Cotter gets transported to New South Wales.
Yep.
Now, we're very used to the idea that the convict system was, well, an expression of British brutality. You know, this idea that the UK just tossed out its unwanted masses and dumped them on this distant shore to live in torment. That's really the argument that you get in Robert Hughes's famous book, The Fatal Shore. But you show a much, well, kindlier system, actually, of the convict system. Can you talk to me about that?
To me, the standard view of the convict has overlooked the fact that, really, many of our forebears did very well and worked hard and became very good citizens. Well, Cotter is one of those, and he's transported, not really in our eyes, for a crime, for a protest, really. He's only a young man, and all his fears are worst. And when he gets here, he's just surprised to discover that his first master is a rather gruff but a kindly man, and that his second master, the one who takes up most of the book, is a fellow, well, a descendant. He's a free-born, but he's the descendant of an Irish convict himself.
Frank Kenny is this bloke's name.
That's Frank Kenny, yes, who settled on the edge of Lake George. Mm.
I must say, Richard, I think you're absolutely right about the convict system. I think that certainly there were hard-hearted people in Britain who set up the convict system for reasons of wanting to sort of rid themselves of vermin. But there are also liberal progressive people in England who saw the convict system as a way of giving people a second chance. It actually was an investment in the idea that fallen people could be redeemed.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, in the book, there are both orders of character, I suppose you'd say, but certainly there are characters in the book who are, in fact, historical characters. Terence Aubrey Murray, the man who built Yarralumla, where the Governor-General currently lives, for example, was a man of great humanity. And I've tried to paint that in the small cameo sort of appearances that he makes in the story.
So, as you say, this is all played out on Aboriginal land. And the unexpected event in Cotter's life is that he develops this, well, close friendship, really, with an Aboriginal leader named, is it Onyong? Is that how you say it?
Onyong. There are many ways of his name being said, as there were then. There remain so now. But I've called him Onyong in the book. Yeah.
Now, he was a real person.
Oh, he was a real person. And a rather reclusive and much feared, actually, Aboriginal leader. And for good reason, too. He was a rather fierce man, and in internecine warfare amongst the Aborigines, he was very much feared. and he did not, like many of the others, Europeanise quickly at all. And Cotter, his relationship with Cotter, therefore, was quite an exceptional thing in his life as well as in Cotter's.
Now, there was terrible violence on the frontier. You don't shrink from that. Can you tell us about that? What precipitated the violence on the frontier in that part of the country?
Well, it was almost always over land. Sometimes it was over women, and in both of those cases are represented in my story. There is a true story of two hut keepers around Lake George who was speared by the Aborigines for stealing their young women, and that precipitated, you know, some considerable violence.
Well, there were stories, weren't there, of white men molesting Aboriginal women in terrible ways, keeping them prisoners in huts for their own sexual pleasure. I mean, that's what happened in the famous Mile Creek case.
Indeed, and this is precisely what's assumed to have happened here, but no one knows the full detail because both of the culprits were killed by the Aborigines. Mm.
I wonder whether you're putting a kind of hypothetical to us as you write this book, as you explore this friendship between these two men, that maybe the arrival of the sheep men in the Aboriginal territories could have been less violent.
Yes, I don't think in actual fact that there is a tremendous amount of violence, direct violence. I think the violence, certainly, and as I've tried to portray it, is much subtler. It's of gradual displacement. It's of betrayal. It's of misunderstanding. There are those sorts of factors which come into it, as far as I'm aware, anyway, in this region. Mm. There weren't head-on confrontations, even though Onyong was actually speared by one of the early settlers here, a man called Henry Hall, who still has a small village named after him, actually.
Mm. So Cotter is one of those settlers who really starts to understand where the Aborigines are coming from. And he says at one point, Onyong and the other blackfellas, they be seeing the country different from us. I should say, listener, he's got an Irish accent, but I'm not going to try that. 'Tis not cut up into square blocks for them, but is all one from the top of the hill to the floor of the river. That's the way the blacks do be looking after the land in their way, and clever with it, he says.
And my understanding, and most of this comes from the Cotter family, this is stories told by the Cotter family and passed down faithfully through the generations. They had a great respect for this man and for what he did for their forebear. So, yes, I've tried to capture that. And that's, I think, the bit you quoted is Cotter trying to explain to the aforesaid Terence Aubrey Murray, to Murray, a little bit of his insight and what he's seen in his years of living with the black people.
How did you research this? I mean, how do you know that Cotter had these attitudes, for example?
Well, once again, and this is where the subtitle of the book is a novel, and I'm making it very clear that this is a work of the imagination. However, my imagination in that area was informed very directly by Cotter family attitudes towards the man himself and the ways in which they narrated the stories about him. On another level, I've tapped into the collective memory of local descendants of the Aborigines who Cotter came to know. And I suppose they'd be the main two sources for my imagining.
Oh, well, this is a good source, though. So you've got an oral tradition among the descendants of Cotter, but also an oral tradition among the descendants of the traditional owners.
Exactly.
And in fact, descendants of Onyong himself were at your book launch.
Indeed. And it's been lovely. One of the really nice things about the book, one of the side benefits, is that it has brought together again the descendants of these two men in a real, I think, a significant open act of honouring of their ancestors and honouring of the ways in which they related to each other. And that's been a lovely byproduct of the book.
Well, I loved reading it, Richard. I really enjoyed reading it so much. How did you go about writing it? Did you plan it? Did you organise the research that you'd done in some way? Or did it just happen organically?
Look, it was a combination. I dreamed it really for some years, and I imagined scenes. I've been to many of the places where Cotter was, and I suppose I tried to work my way through it mentally and imaginatively first, and then I sat down probably 3 years ago and began the hard research. And that was a fascinating process, and I enjoyed that immensely. And I had to then seriously think about planning and editing and so on the book.
Well, there's a real sense in the way you tell the story that you know the country.
Well, indeed. It's country which I've mustered and run stock on and come to know, particularly in younger days. And it's country that I love, and it's country that a lot of people love. I mean, people will know a lot of this country through, I suppose, Miles Franklin and that sort of literature. And there are myriad bushwalkers today who can testify to their love for this country.
Richard Begbie's novel Cotter is published by a small publisher called Longhand Press. And as you can hear, Michael Cathcart was immensely impressed by it.